So we're waiting for Varn to come on. What do you think his reaction to Hot Commie Summer is going to be? Do you think he's going to be hyped, or is he going to be pissed?
Well, I know Derek Varn pretty well. I wouldn't say he's going to be pissed. I think he's going to be ornery.
All right.
There's going to be like various takes that he encountered. There's going to be various people that he talked to. There's going to be DSA caucuses who riled him up with their what he would consider very bad takes. And I think he's going to be upset about something.
What historical rabbit holes are we going to go down?
I tell you exactly what historical rabbit hole we're going to go down. Welcome to episode one of the Antifada, 2018. What a great year to start a podcast. You've got socialists, democratic socialists, insurgent. You have Donald Trump upending politics. You have the millennial left staking its claim in a major American city. You have an upset of an incumbent. What's his name? Crowley in Queens? No, it's Andrew Cuomo this time. But yes, this may as well be. Time is a flat circle. This may as well be 2018 when we started this podcast. We're in the doom loop. We're in the eternal return. Nietzsche was right. It is going to be 2016 forever, folks. And we're here to document
that's it. That's your historical illusion. That's where you go back to. That's where I go back to as well. Yeah. I'm wondering if he's going to go back to the New Deal or something. New Deal doesn't really. Yeah, I would. Yeah, maybe like FDR's second election.
Did you read the? It was the interview. It came out in the Times today. You could have read it or listened to it. It was Chris Hayes.
Yeah, I saw you link to it, but I haven't heard it yet.
Oh, it's like very long. But one of the
15 minutes ago.
One of the things that Chris Hayes and Ezra Klein of Abundance fame talk about is that Democrat politicians, cause this is really what their focus is, right? They're trying to like save progressivism from itself. Hey, there's Derek Varn. What's up, man? Hey, there we go.
Good morning. See Derek Varn.
Hello, Varn. We are recording on Sunday morning. Welcome to the year 2018. This is episode one of our new podcast, The Antifada.
Welcome to year zero.
This is year zero. We're back. It's like Groundhog Day. We've returned to a time when a socialist has overthrown an incumbent. Democratic socialism and the millennial left are on the rise. What's your take? We already like predicted that you would be ornery about this situation, that you would have people that have made you very mad and you'd have some ornery takes. What do you got?
I don't really have ornery takes because I don't listen to leftists who don't do labor work anymore. I suppose I am frustrated by both the people who naysay about like this isn't the Marxist-Leninist party situation that come about, so we shouldn't care. But I also think this is repetition compulsion.
Where we feel compelled to point out the repetition, or this is repetition compelling itself?
It's repetition compelling itself. And it's, I mean, like, let's look at the history of the DSA, not just the history of the DSA since 2016, but the history of the DSA since like 1978 or whatever, the proto organizations and all that, which came out of the dissolution of the Socialist Party of America in the 60s. The initial growth of the DSA was about what? I mean, like, if we think about it, it was about opposition to Reagan, the beginning of the Rainbow Coalition and the Jesse Jackson campaign, and a New York mayoral candidate,
David Dinkins, like, folks.
Right. What I find amazing in this is like, for example, there have been other major city DSA endorsed mayors, all of them have gone pretty poorly. I mean, Brandon Johnson's now more unpopular than Lori Lightfoot was. And that's not Brandon Johnson's fault per se. it's because what does the DSA and what are these progressives and these social Democrats who
just do? Just to be clear, just to clarify, Brandon Johnson is the mayor of Chicago, right?
We're Chicago, yeah.
Thank you.
Who was a DSA endorsed candidate who like social democratic adjacent or democratic socialist adjacent? Those words really mean the same thing. I wish we quit pretending that they didn't. Adjacent progressive mayor of Chicago who has achieved about as much as Lori Lightfoot achieved, and that's because these executive offices still exist in a political context with downstream political actors and upstream political actors. You need a state legislature that you can interact with. You need city council members that you can interact with. These progressive mayors often have none of those. And this isn't just something that we've seen with Brandon Johnson. We're likely to see him in Donnie if he even wins. But it's also... I mean, we saw it with Dennis Kucinich and the '80s. I mean, like, there's a long history of this exact form of failure.
Yeah.
And what gets me about it is this could create an opportunity for people to do things around this. But you know what I get? I get like, oh, we should just keep these people activated the way that we, you know, Obama kept his thing activated. Well, there's two problems with that. One is the candidates don't really want to do that. But two, it's hard to keep grassroots stuff like that activated for more than a year or two if you don't deliver any goods, and you can't because you started from an executive position without building any infrastructure around that. And building that infrastructure with, I don't know, 70,000 people, if I am really, really, optimistic in the DSA.
New York, they claim to have 50,000 canvassers. So
50,000 canvassers. Okay.
Their theory is that 50,000 will just continue to be, they're going to do like what Obama failed to do, where they're just going to stay mobilized and stay pushing. Yeah. So if Hochul won't raise the taxes on the 1%, they're going to go to Albany. If Trump cuts federal funding, I don't know what they're going to do.
Go to Washington.
New York State into a like war communism situation. I think that's
war communism in one city.
Well, I guess the idea is that maybe they can take control of the state Democratic Party. Like, I feel like the hope is that the New York State Democrats are falling apart, and that the Zohran momentum is going to fill the void.
All right, let's back up for a second. Varn, before you arrived, I was reading, Andy, a letter, which I will not read because it's private correspondence within the union. But basically, it was our executive secretary saying, look, we won 99% of the politicians we endorsed in the city. And of course, like a lot of those are safe seats. But that 1%, that beguiling 1%, of course, was endorsing Andrew Cuomo. Fear not, rank and file members who put your time and energy into canvassing and rallying, maybe even put a little, you know, cash on the barrel head for good old Andrew Cuomo. Fear not. We are now in the top echelon of mayoral campaigns. We are now moving forward, going to be at the forefront of this. This is our promise to you. I'm wearing a t-shirt right now that says New York City Carpenters on the front and on the back. I'm not going to get up to show you guys on video because the listeners wouldn't see it anyway. On the back, it says union power grows out of the ballot box. You heard it here first, folks. It grows out of the ballot box, and we have a plan. There's a plan to use the ballot box. Even as private work collapses, we have seen an absolute collapse in our ability to gain private work, but the public work, public works, and buying off politicians and being the most successful ralliers. This is the way that we're going to continue to be a going enterprise in this city moving forward. So that's what the constituency of Andrew Cuomo says. Apparently, there's only, you know, there was a handful of constituencies and we were one of them. But fear not, we're going to prevail.
Union power comes out of the ballot box by backing a known, wasn't so much anti-union president, governor, but one who was not particularly pro-union historically, not more than the average New York neoliberal. I guess
he's a machine politician, right? So like he understands unions as part of the machine that you need to build unions, black pastors, you know, in churches, the NGOs. You need to build power, what, with like La Raza, you know, like Hispanic organizations or whatever. It's a coalitional politics, right? Like, to back up a little bit, one of the reasons you would endorse Andrew Cuomo, and one of the reasons why, or I think maybe the most compelling reason to back him, not that I did, would be that Albany and the city have this like delicate dance they do that is not so delicate. It involves like bashing one another across the face. And we've seen this over and over again for over 100 years. And if you want somebody to bash the next guy, to bang some heads together, to go up to Albany, knock some heads against the wall, if you want a head chopper, Andrew Cuomo is your guy because he plays the fucking game. Mamdani is going to get eaten alive. That is like the sense that people have, right? The professional politicians have a sense that even if he does win, he's going to get the living shit kicked out of him, because politics grows out of the ballot box, or union power grows out of the ballot box. But like politics in New York State grows out of the machine. And Mamdani's DSA supporters are not a machine. They're like canvassers and protesters or whatever. That's the idea.
I mean, there is a tiny core of truth to that, and that the DSA has not managed to be a political machine for one primary reason, and that is it can't scale up its money. I mean, the DSA, what, 2 years ago was barely solvent. Trying to run nationwide electoral campaigns with a coalition of 100,000 and not even have the patronage that, say, the Party for Socialism and Liberation has, which, you know, where it can like throw money at front groups and whatever through getting weird, weird amounts of millions through the People's Forum, and whatnot. The DSA doesn't have that because it actually is an organic organization, but that also means it spends most of its money, rightly or wrongly, on running itself. 80% of its dues go to the national, 20% stays local. Locals have to institute their own due structures. They give grants to politicians of like $5,000. I hate to tell you, but unless you have millions in a country of 330 million, you don't have the people to protect this. And the money, that amount of money, that won't help you keep a city council seat in Provo, Utah.
Right.
Like five grand is nothing.
Yeah. What do you think, Andy?
Yeah, the DSA has consistently shown what it can do, what it's able to do, by running candidates that inspire a lot of people to get involved and fight for them, and, you know, have some hope in their lives that things can change on a political level. And they've experimented with other things too. You know, there's an entire abstentionist wing of the DSA that has interesting projects. Like, for example, I went to the Communist Caucus's release of their journal Long Haul a couple weeks ago. Yeah. And it was, they had a long list of workers speaking about their workplace struggles, including people from Amazon, teachers unions, experiencing ICE raids, reporting back on that, telling people how to get more involved. And their journal is, you know, more or less like a worker's inquiry with some historical essays and some analysis about the current moment. The DSA is a very dynamic organization. I have never been a part of it. I don't really know what it looks like from the inside. But it's hard to, from the outside perspective, it's hard to be too much of a naysayer because they have these big goals that they succeed at. You know, I remember when they were talking about running Zoran, they were thinking about not doing it because they're like, well, are we still going to go through this electoral route? Does he have a chance to win? Is this just going to be a protest candidate? And they found, you know, they found a very strong politician and a very smart guy, and he's really gifted, and the people around him were very gifted at running a new style of campaign. It's a different style of campaign than what AOC won. Maybe it's similar to Brandon Johnson. I don't know what his campaign was like. But you have to hand it to any leftist organization that has a goal and succeeds at their goal.
But they haven't succeeded at their larger goals ever. Well, like getting some professional politician, which you did not create and you cannot protect, into a position so that they can do legislation or do mandates without ever getting the legislative backing to do that is a pseudo goal. Like it's the same shit from the Rainbow Coalition forward. I really, really, really get tired of us making excuses for it.
Mm.
Like they achieve their goals. What national or even local policy goal have they ever achieved? Do you have Medicare for all? Even the watered down versions that the Democrats promised in 2019? No. Do you, in every front that they supposedly cared about, they have failed. They can't do anything about college education policy. They haven't even focused on primary schools. They do not enter in races that would be low bar entries. They go for the biggest games first. They do big historic wins, and then when the Democrats are in power, they turn on their candidates because their candidates don't do what they ask. But as soon as that goes out of business, we forget it all. Like we don't have to be impressed with a bunch of fucking activists from the richest part of the country, basically failing. And I'm frankly sick about hearing about hope. I don't give a shit about hope. Like hope keeps people threaded along. That's how you keep people from doing what they need to do, is you give them hope. I mean, I'm sorry, Andy, but like I hear this and it just makes me furious because we should not be making excuses for this. Like we have seen it fail over and over and over again. And structurally, logically, game theoretically, it cannot win. You have not done the preemptive work, even if you were going to do this strategy, for it to win.
It can win if you're setting goals. I don't know what DSA, if I don't know if they have a document that says what their long-term goals are. But if they're setting goals of, we're going to run candidates in this election and we're going to get some wins, they have won in like the New York City mayor Democratic primary. That is, on its own terms, that is a win. I don't think anyone has any illusion about how difficult it's going to be to enact Zoran's very modest agenda. Very modest. We're talking about de Blasio politics.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I mean, I think, like, the larger goal is that they are going to take over the Democratic Party in some degree or move the Democratic Party to the left. We'll see when that succeeds. You know, if it fails. Obviously, these are different goals than our, you know, and I don't think their goal is to be, like, inspire hope in the Democratic Party or in the United States. I don't know if that is a stated goal.
They don't have a set goal. Their NPC can't even agree on what their set goals are. But yet
they can put up a candidate for mayor and get a bunch of canvassers and find a very charismatic guy and back him to the hilt. Almost as, I feel like, a default strategy, right? The path of least resistance is to find somebody on the progressive wing of Democratic Party politics, back them to the hilt, claim them as your own, even maybe help them work on their policy platform, certainly help them with their get out the vote operations and media operations, and then declare victory from there. I think maybe the reason why it's despite the chaos within the NPC and despite the kind of, I think, serious disagreements within DSA about what their organization should do, the fact that it defaults back to a New York City mayoral candidate says something about the impasse that we're at right now. We keep kind of playing with this idea of eternal return. Like, we keep falling back to either 2018, 2016, or maybe to de Blasio, to David Dinkins. And there's a reason for that. And there's an objective reason for that. And a subjective reason too, which is that the left is at this impasse. And Zoran for NYC DSA, you could say, was perhaps the path of least resistance, right? Let's put up a candidate. It's not to endorse the strategy. It's only to say that perhaps it's a strategy that arises out of weakness and not out of strength, or a disunity, not out of unity.
Well, I think any leftist organization or tendency has got to build something that people can join, that people think is effective in some way. And we're critics of the DSA and that they're an electoralism. I don't think we're abstentionists, but we're not, you know, we don't agree with Sean's shirt that union power comes, like, grows out of the barrel of the ballot box or whatever. But you know, like, if there are millions of Americans who want to fight in some way, and they see DSA running this insurgent candidate and winning, and their organization is going to grow.
I do think this is potentially a good, the organization is going to grow and then it's going to shrink again, which is what it's done, like a metabolic process, literally since its existence. And unlike the kind of the grand period of socialism in America in the 1920s, where there was kind of a linear growth without this shrink, add mentality. What is radically different is that labor unions are part of the former structure of labor management in a real way. They are predominantly public sector, and the public sector is not even covered by the same legal protections that people in the DSA talk about all the time. I mean, Eric Blanc, the guy who wrote Red State Revolt about the teachers thing, is constantly talking about changes to the NCL, the National Labor Relations Board under Biden. That's what he did for 4 years. Mm. And I hate to tell you, but more workers are not covered, even if they are in unions, by the National Labor Relations Act and thus the National Labor Relations Board, than are, because they are either in exempted categories or they are in public sector unions, which fall under completely different sectors of law and only gain their right to exist through wildcat strikes in the 60s and early 70s. The legalization of a lot of this work means that we have to play within rules that are not set in our agenda and interest. Mandani is interesting because the one thing I will say is, unlike the naysayers who are just like, oh, this isn't, you know, going to lead us to full communism, thus this is some kind of like hoodwink, mm-hmm. is there's a real organic thing there. But the goals, if we take the goal to get, because I literally had the Marxist Unity Group caucus come on my show recently, and they explicitly said our goal is not to get executive candidates in because it probably doesn't really represent the people. It's a shortcut. It's inherently class collaborationist, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the Marxist Unity Group is powerful in the DSA, but it's actually very small. All the major caucuses are way smaller.
They back Zoran, though. They're like one of the kind of ultra tendencies that did back Zoran.
Right. I mean, and they back Zoran with the caveat that that they did it as a stand against Zionism. I mean, mm-hmm. that was their logic for it. And that probably is some of what is propelling Zoran's candidacy.
Yes.
I don't want to come out as like against Mandani, and I actually do think crushing people's hope, which there's a lot of like ultra, and let's not just pretend it's ultra groups. It's also like normie MLs, who do this, ignoring their own historical tradition while they do it, but nonetheless,
but pushing hopes is like part of a broader strategy, right? Which is like, oh, the masses will vote for Zoran. And then when they're disappointed by, you know, all the impediments, structural impediments to him, or when they're frustrated when he sells us down the river, then they'll come and join the Party for Socialism and Liberation. Then they'll join my Trotskyist sect, right?
So, or, like, yeah,
illusion,
or my Marxist Leninist sect. But yeah, go ahead.
No, no, it's part of the strategy, I guess, is what I'm saying.
I mean, yeah, and it's, but go ahead, Sean. I'm so mean to talk over you. I just, I want to point out one historical thing.
Please,
that, that exact strategy was the strategy that Marx criticized, that Godet tried to use in France, the French Marxist. Like, that is where the I am not a Marxist thing comes from, is because Marx was like, don't promise reforms that you can't deliver to radicalize the population, because you don't really know what they're going to be radicalized, in what way they're going to be radicalized. But what you do know is they're not going to trust you because you lied to them. And I mean, my thing lately is I've been talking about thermostatic politics versus anti-systemic politics. Anti-systemic politics and thermostatic politics look alike, all right, in America anyway, and in Europe too. What do I mean by that? Something that seems to be anti-status quo is angry at part of the currently existing status quo and wants to a different part of that status quo, convinces itself that is anti the current system while backing some other element of the system, right? That is the predominant move, left and right, like in America. And it is also the predominant move in Europe. If we talk about leftist goals, if our goals do not take that into account, and admit that this is not necessarily the Overton window opportunity against the larger system, it is an expression of discontent on a specific element of it, that we may be able to leverage. And everyone will say that they're doing that, but then what happens? What happens? I mean, the current resistance is interesting in that if I actually had to tell you who's been the most active in it, it's things like the Lincoln Project and the Bulwark. If you go to these No Kings thing, these have massive corporate backers for a reason. Bill Kristol's on their side. I mean, he's even talking about defending Mondani, because he, even though they were campaigning against him kind of until recently, but the horror of the turn against Mondani has propelled them. And I think some of that's sincere, but I also think what that's about is they know that he's capturable, if not already a creature of that world.
Yeah.
And, you know, so, and I mean, we see this with Bernie too.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but just to be clear on terms, so there's thermostatic, you said, and then there's, what's the other one?
Anti-systemic. So thermostatic is just a thermostat. It reacts to the discontent of the current. Sometimes we call this the anti-political sentiment. I don't like calling it the anti-political sentiment because it's not really anti-political. People will convince themselves that some element of the status quo is really going to break it. Like, I mean, we all know leftists who convince themselves that Trump was somehow going to break the status quo and that would be good for the left. Trump did break the status quo in some ways, but he also represents a large part of the same status quo. I mean, I pointed out, like, Pete Hegseth went to Harvard. I don't know, like these this, people are just a counter elite.
with multipolarity, and you see this with Mearsheimer and political realism, what is it, international realism, right? You start to realize that you can get a lot of interesting information, a lot of good historical stuff, and a lot of, I think, good diplomatic analysis of like where various different capitalist states are landing and different politicians within them, right? But what it is as you said, like a counter power within the system that doesn't claim that the system of nation states such as it exists is redundant, like it needs to be overthrown. It instead takes them at, realistically, as like the basic building blocks of geopolitical power, and argues that their framework, their understanding, and ultimately their personnel, which are waiting in the wings, will be better at managing the international order than the people who are in power now. And that's fine. Like, when you listen to them, if you have that, if you bear that in mind, that multipolarity is a claim based upon certain precepts that we don't share, then I think you can get some very valuable information from that. But to imagine that it is like a, it has some sort of revolutionary potential, I think you're constantly going to run up against reality and bash your head against it. This is similar. I mean, the Mamdani, the situation we're in right now feels, as we've talked about, like a retread. It feels like people are being hoodwinked. It feels as though, and I said this last time we discussed this, Andy, a couple weeks ago with our friend Maddie, it feels as though, for good reason, that a local race is being turned national and ultimately international in its alleged importance, because largely there has been a collapse in the National Democratic Party that Trump represents. Obviously, Trump's win represents a defeat of a certain type of liberalism and a definitive defeat of a Democratic Party leadership, which is old and out of touch, let's be honest. And so when you saw the pictures of Zoran meeting with David Hogg, right, and the two of them combining forces, you could see that on top of everything else, we can talk about capitalist politics, we can talk about socialist politics, social democracy, democratic socialism, the Democrats, whatever. On top of everything else, it appears as though this is what a generational shift within progressivism, within the Democratic Party, is going to look like. It's going to look like AOC's shock victory. She's now completely brought into the power structure of the Democratic Party, and presumably so will Zoran, but with a reinvigorated energy that brings people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s back into a party which, on the national level, the rank and file is extremely upset, it seems, has done nothing really to stem the tide of MAGA and Trumpism, especially as pertains to like the norms and the rules of American democracy. So really, I don't think Zoran can be seen except as, well, one of the ways in which Zoran can be seen as an insurgency within the Democratic Party to change the terms, to change the generational composition of the leadership of a party that everybody knows has kind of lost its way in a similar way to, say, the Republican Party in 2008.
I want to push this to both you and Andy, because I yelled, and I'm pretty upset about some of this stuff. I don't lose sleep over it anymore. I don't watch Twitter over it. I barely engage in the Twitter debates. But I want to point out that actually I was fighting just as much with the hyper naysayers about this meaning nothing. The fact that this repetition compulsion comes up again and again and again actually does indicate something beyond just our some nostalgia for 2016 or 1984 or 1968 or something like that. It also indicates that there is a real objective question that isn't being solved. The Democrats' gambit that made them so popular in 2007 and into the Obama years does not work right now. But what is very interesting, if you like look at the general opinion of the progressive left in the public, not just the Democrats, people don't really like them. I mean, they do, and you're in like New York and LA, and I guess those have huge populations, but like in general, you have the same problem that you've had now, if we were to believe Chomsky, literally since the 50s, that progressive policies are popular, progressives aren't. No one asks the question as to why, and the reason why is progressives do not and have not generally delivered on progressive policies outside the context of either the Soviet Union, which occasionally people will bring up, but they bring it up in this hyper passive way. I encountered, I get on, left liberal Instagram sometimes because for some reason, seeing people's faces makes me hate them less. And so I listened to this guy going, oh, well, now that the Soviet Union's gone, there's nothing to make capitalist do anything. And okay, fine. But then the result is we are just going to be cooked. I'm like, okay, so this is still a hyper passive worldview. Where did the Soviet Union come from? Like, was it just, you know, a thing that was brought into existence, like really nilly out of nothing? And I'm, you know, I know that we all share slightly different opinions of the Soviet Union, but none of us actually think it lived up to its historical mission or can be repeated. I mean, that's the one thing we all share. And I look at that and go, so somebody's half realizing this, but they come to a very passive point of view. What I find very interesting, Andy, that maybe is an indication of both weakness and power simultaneously, and maybe we should stop thinking about this in binary terms, is that they got 50,000 canvassers. Now, canvassing 50,000 canvassers, that organization that we're talking about, the DSA, is what's totally got these 50,000 canvassers, is only 60 to 70,000 people by their own records. They might grow from this, but I want to point out that this is the first time in our lifetimes where, by my math, there are way more former DSAers than there are DSAers. Like, if you look at the number of recruits they get per year versus current 70,000, I know that those probably still have the 100,000 on their website, but if you look at their own internal numbers, which they do make public, and I want to give the DSA credit for that, it's probably about 70,000 with the boost post-Trump. If we see this, you know, it's going to be interesting to see what happens with all those people, because the one thing I can tell you won't happen is keeping them mobilized for more than 2 years at the level of mobilization of a campaign. That will not happen unless you have wins, unless you have ways to recharge them, unless you have ways to let them off. This idea of eternal mobilization, which a lot of current electoralists, people who want an independent party, people who think this will come about other ways, also basically argue for, which is an internally mobilized, hyper-mobilized public, you know, like the return of mass politics. Well, I like to tell people that even in the context of world wars, mass politics only lasted about 10 years. And that was with millions of people dying on the regular, which we aren't yet seeing, although with the current multipolar world, we are beginning to get closer to that. I think right now there's the most conflicts we have seen, proxy conflicts we have seen since World War II. The death tolls in Gaza are like the death tolls in Belarus, Belarusia leading up to World War II, during World War II. It is quite bad. So I want to ask you and Andy, instead of like us just going like, either they accomplish their goals, because I mean, yeah, they accomplished this goal. I just don't think the goal is going to mean much. Or going, oh, you know, this is control opposition, which it may be. There is something organic here. What do we do with it? Because we have blown it. I think we have all lived through it being blown, I think, at least 3 or 4 times. Like, we have seen this at least 3 or 4 times where we've seen a movement build up, it gets blown, a movement build up, it gets blown. And what we're seeing right now, which is interesting coalitionally, is that there's going to be people scrambling to use Mamdani. I mean, the fact that like these former neoconservatives turned Democrats are interested in talking to him, and he may be defending him, despite the fact that most of them are like pretty hardcore Zionist. Like, what does that mean? That does indicate something is changing. And like, the question for me that's more productive is, what can we do with that? Because I do, like I said, I don't give a crap about hope, but if something gives people hope, it does indicate that subjective conditions are changing. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
Yeah, so I think you and I wrote an article right after Trump won the election in November called The Undying Appeal of Brunch. Mm-hmm. And I think the significance of that piece was, let's like engrave how we feel right now as a sort of something for us to go back to and remind ourselves of what the significance of Trump's second election was, which was the same exact thing that we felt when he won the first time. We are done with the Democratic Party. We have to remember that the Democratic Party exists to put Trump in power over and over again and to convince us that there's some hope within the Democratic Party in the interim. And in that piece, we also talk about the things that these other actions that we do like and support and are powerful because they represent something outside of the outside of the representative government, outside of voting. The movement against ICE during Trump's first administration, which we're now seeing return. The anti-fascist movement, to some extent. The No Kings movement is something of a return of, like, the Women's March, kind of like mass mobilizations against the Trump agenda. The airport blockades, George Floyd uprising, you know. And so we were sort of, a vulgar way of reading that article is that we are into this spontaneous mass action as a way out of this impasse of, like, you know, the pendulum swinging back and forth between the Democrats and the Republicans. But I think that both sides of that, the abstentionists and the electoralists, and this exists within the DSA, as we've talked about, has the same exact issue, which is that how do we find the composition of people who are going to struggle and continue to struggle in a way that can actually change the political terrain towards a situation where the working class can actually fight and take power. And it, what I found so interesting about the last few months is that when I talk to liberals, when I talk to you know, anyone who's like watching what Trump is doing with concern and wondering how things are going to change, anarchists, liberals, communists, they all kind of have the same exact reaction to everything. Wow, we're really fucked. What is it going to take to stop this? What is it going to take to change things? And everyone kind of has the same answers. It's like, well, I guess I'll go to the No Kings March. I guess I'll vote for Mamdani. I guess I'll even canvass for Mamdani. You know, I'll join a list and watch Shout for ICE. You know, everybody across the political spectrum is kind of on the same page.
Subscribe to Hassan's streams. Subscribe to the Antifada or the Varn Vlog, right? These are other options.
That would be nice.
Yeah, I'll take it.
If we are going back to 2017, maybe we can get some of those subscribers back, but that's certainly not our goal either. My point with this is that I think, you know, Mamdani is not our style of politics. You know, he is, I strongly feel that his goal is to just bring back de Blasio style politics to Gracie Mansion. That's marginally good. But the enthusiasm for him, yeah, it is a bit of a thermostat that people are ready and willing to fight for something different. And, you know, I think what mobilized people, part of it was affordability, sure. I think what was larger than that, you know, I talked to a friend last night who was like, yeah, I didn't like Zohran because I thought he was just this, not a transplant because he like grew up in the city, but I thought he was like a rich kid. You know, when people talk about like the Nepo baby charge against him, they write it off because they say, well, compared to Cuomo, he's no Nepo baby. But a lot of New Yorkers saw him and were like, oh, I know people like this. This is like a hipster socialist kind of person who's out of touch with what working class life is actually like. He didn't grow up poor. But what mobilized her and a lot of her friends who grew up in the city for Zohran was seeing him being attacked on the stage about Israel.
Right.
So, yeah, I think
this is one of the ways in which the election got nationalized, right, is a radicalization, it feels like, of the political class in this country as the Gaza war has continued to really, of course, make support for Israel as a Jewish state kind of this essential political symbol, I think, for like Westernism and freedom. I think that trying to smear Zohran with this in the debate and elsewhere might have maybe worked like a year or so ago. But I feel like that it's kind of run its course a little bit. And we can see, I think, a backlash to that maybe within this campaign, as you say, Andy.
What I'm trying to say here is, yeah, Zoran has built this composition that, you know, I've heard described as the broad middle, like the 60% of, you know, Cuomo wins narrowly with the poorest voters and the richest voters. And then the broad middle 60% votes for Zoran. What were they voting for? Were they anti-Zionist votes? Were they anti-Democrat votes? Were they bread and butter? Was it about affordability? I think, you know, all of these things are true. But yeah, I mean, this is a popular front strategy, and it succeeded on its own terms. And we're going to see how it plays out. We don't really have any control, you know, as podcasters or as, you know, individuals over how it plays out. Mm. But this is part of the political terrain that we are struggling on in our own struggles. And, you know, if we're critical of the popular front, we do have to take into account, I think, that this is a popular front that's against the Democratic Party. It's against the Republican Party. It'll vote if it sees a reason to vote, but voting is not the point of it. And I think maybe that is a difference from 8 years ago, is that there was this idea that the Democrats would save us then. And now the idea is Zoran is not, we're not voting Zoran in as a new type of Democrat. We're trying to basically destroy the Democratic Party. And so I think actually it might be better for the DSA if the Democrats keep fighting Zoran. And that's why I think it's good that Cuomo is going to keep running for mayor, is because we're going to continue to have this spectacle of like a more or less normal, charming socialist guy who is not really yielding on Israel.
Authentic seeming and charismatic, you know, very like an Obama figure, trying to recreate an Obama coalition.
But he's also very smart.
And very smart.
I mean, Obama's smart too. But so, yeah, I think the significance of that is that, you know, he is a figurehead of a movement that wants to fight the Democratic Party as much as he wants to fight Trump.
I take that all. I think that there's a lot of truth to that. I think that when we look at these things, and I don't want to land on like the naysayer, and I certainly don't want to be a hope monger. I want to kind of get at the Marxist center of this whole thing. There's something that's akin to when we look at urban politics. I've been thinking about this a lot, something akin to like K waves that are happening behind like the political economy of the city. There's our entire lives, you know, and Varun, you live in a city too, right? You live in Salt Lake City region too. Our entire lives have been kind of punctuated, whether it's culturally with the music that we listen to or with the movies we watch, or certainly with the politics that all of us have grown up with. We're used to a certain type of urban politics, which is urban politics of like fighting austerity, right? We're constantly relitigating the 1970s here in New York City and the financial crisis. Like CUNY used to be free. We used to have tons of well-funded public hospitals, and that was taken from us by these austerity regimes in the 1970s. I feel like in terms of like K waves, we're kind of maybe moving into something else, something different, which is maybe the terrain on which all of this is happening. And de Blasio represents this, and maybe Dinkins in a dark way represented it too, that like, if the problems of previous periods, if the problems that Ed Koch and Rudy Giuliani were trying to face were problems of disinvestment, problems of capital flight, problems of taxpaying middle class and working class voters leaving the city for the suburbs, you now have kind of the opposite problem, an opposite problem that's been on the rise for decades, which is overinvestment in things like housing, rising property values, rich people or like well-heeled people moving back to the cities and raising the prices, causing an affordability crisis. In New York City, it's very much the opposite problems that you would have seen in the 1980s and 1990s. And therefore, the politics that we see of Zoran, the politics of de Blasio, are, I think, explicable and understandable. And this isn't a way to like poo-poo them completely, but it's a way to understand them, explicable through long cycles of investment and disinvestment in cities and urban areas, and the kind of capitalist politics that arise from these. situations, right? And Mamdani and previously de Blasio with his pre-K, universal pre-K, highly popular program and highly essential program for many working class New Yorkers when childcare is so expensive, is kind of the fact that these politics are quote unquote succeeding, I think maybe tells us something about the broader moment that we're in right now, urban political economy and maybe American political economy as a whole. This is all happening at the same time as a sort of technocratic neoliberalism is more and more delegitimated, right? But it's an attempt to find something new. What do you think, Varn?
I want to parse out a lot of the claims made very carefully because I agree in the broad strokes, but I want to like pull this really carefully apart. One, there is a delicate balance, one might even say a dialectical tension between voluntarism and determinism and all this stuff. My fear is that weirdly, both hyper-voluntarism and hyper-determinism lead people to being very passive. Mm. I also think, to point out, when we point out stuff that's new, I want to go back to a different moment. We can talk about BLM and why people have actively tried to forget it, and we can talk about Occupy and why people have actively tried to forget it. But what do those two things share? BLM, in its initial instance, not in its second instance, was a reaction to the Obama administration and the reaction to policing in the industrial heartland that has been deindustrialized in the upper Midwest. And it spread the first time from that core, then into the lower end of the Rust Belt, Mid-Atlantic, Maryland, and then into college campuses, where it completely changed its politics and what it talked about and was recapitulated by the Democratic Party. Similar with Occupy. Occupy was not a response to Republicans. It was a response to Democrats not keeping any of the implied promises of dealing with the outcomes of the 2007-2008 recession, where even Republicans at one point were calling for a temporary nationalization of the banks. I mean, Mitch McConnell did this, and it's wild to remember. And we also saw similar things during COVID. All right. That seems a million miles away. I hear from all kinds of people that neoliberalism is over. Only if you think the key element of neoliberalism was global integration in the economy, which also isn't over, by the way. It's just gotten a lot more hairy for reasons that those of us who are materialists could probably really spend some time and pull out. In all of those cases, I do not think it was inherent that those movements got recapitulated. But the fact that they did is also why I think we have trouble looking at them. And even in our own recounting of these things, I mean, Andy's talked about this with BLM, but I think we also need to look at Occupy. It was a similar set of frustrations and conditions that was also reactive, right? What changed the politics of Occupy? Occupy in many ways was a death of a certain kind of politics. We might even see BLM's recuperation as a death of certain kinds of anti-racist politics and a birth of a new kind of anti-racist politics, just like Occupy was a birth of a new kind of opposition to the status quo of the Democratic Party. But what we also saw with the dirtbag left and all that, I mean, is that its stance towards the Democratic Party was both oppositional and incoherent. It could neither break from it nor really stay in it. That's still true. Mm-hmm. Similarly, with the anti-racist politics of BLM, it could neither completely break from the various NGOs and stuff that tie them to the Democratic Party. And in fact, it couldn't so much that it was actually an easy thing to grift on, and I mean that sincerely. But nor could it capitulate to those elements either. And that sort of cognitive dissonance for most individual activists, I think, makes those movements painful to look at, but it makes the movements that emerged out of them easier to look at, even though we should view them, I think, just as painfully, because they are still stuck in that inability to go either way. And we're going to see this with Mamdani, I think. Mamdani is a charismatic guy. He's a good politician. Look, I hate Andrew Cuomo. I would rather deal with Mamdani. I know people would hear my anger here and think that I'm like, oh, I would have voted for someone else. No, I probably would have voted for Mamdani if I was a New Yorker. But I also probably would have done it wide-eyed, knowing that the statistical likelihood based off of the prior DSA mayors is bad. Now, what I don't know, and this is a sincere not knowing, how many of those canvassers understand that? Now, if I base it off social media, they don't. Even people who are like, I am a diehard Maoist, don't. At the same time, I think those people, like I was implying that we talk about the DSA and its representation by these caucuses and the MPC. But most of these MPC caucus groups are between 100 and 500 people. Even they are to the DSA what the DSA is to the Democratic Party in many ways in terms of their size and in terms of what they're orientated to do. I think this really is an aphoria, because the one thing I can tell you that is different is the, and I'm almost going to sound like a right winger for a second, so you're gonna have to bear with me and you can respond to it as you want to. The social peace bought by a move to the administrative and judicial elements of the state in the 1960s, is no longer maintainable. Mm-hmm. And that is manifested in two reactions. One reaction is people realize how they have no control over the military apparatus at all. There's very little. I think the average person, and Gaza makes this particularly clear, this is not like a 9/11 where like the military actions like had like 80% to 90% approval when they started. You know, they became unpopular very, very quickly, but we forget how overwhelmingly popular they were when they started. That was not true, despite the events of October 7th in the case of what's happening in Gaza. But it is also clear that, and I think this became clear in a lot of the incoherence of the Zoomer left or whatever, in light of the Gaza situation in the Biden election, is they don't really have a way. You know, what they realized is the protests aren't going to leverage it, which is why you didn't initially see them at the protest. No King's protests were very gray haired from my experience of them. They were people older than me, and I'm in my 40s. They were big. They were large. You had more excitement about the Bernie AOC tour at first. I mean, I think something like a fifth of the population here in Salt Lake went to that thing. But at the same time, it was still not so much younger people. Unlike Bernie won. And I think that's partly because, I mean, we can talk about the right-wing radicalization of Zoomer boys. I think that that's both under-understood and over-reported. I think we can talk about a lot of different conditions. But if we ask ourselves, what do we do now with this and this generation? They tried the protests. They were involved. They were involved or saw what happened with BLM. They saw that possibly lead to the victory of the Biden administration and be recuperated instantly. Now, the question is, what are they going to do in regards to things like Mamdani? Now, you're talking about the broad middle supporting Mamdani. And that has really to do with foreign policy, all right? I think the question we should ask is, why is the poor supporting Cuomo? And the answer is actually pretty clear if you think about it for a few minutes. They actually do understand that machine politics are how they're going to get something, whereas yeah. their historical experience with progressive candidates is that they fail. Like, it's not that they don't support those policies. They just don't believe that these people are going to do that.
There's a rejection of ideology as well.
Right.
Yeah. A way in which like the common sense taken this city And that's the common sense reason for backing Andrew Cuomo, if you're the Carpenters Union or the Electricians Union or whatever, is that politics in this city is coalitional, sure, but it's a knife fight in the mud, you know, and who would you want? You want the bright-eyed 33-year-old ideologue, right? As Andy pointed out, ideologue, someone who actually truly believes in things, first principles, supposedly, right? And I believe that he does. Or do you want the completely cynical operator, the machine guy, willing to get down in the mud and pull the knife first, you know, before his enemies do? And I think that that's not just, you know, Fox News or CNN pundits and commentators. That I feel like is the common sense sort of take of politics in this city broadly among like the middle stratum, which is that city politics are not ultimately about ideology. It's about bashing heads against the wall. And about fighting Albany and about fighting Washington.
But the challenges that are facing ordinary people in the United States are becoming increasingly resonant with foreign policy, because nobody likes the war in Gaza. No one likes the war in Iran. Trump is aware of this now. He seems to be a little bit fed up with these adventures. But what he's really interested in, what his base is really interested in, is on the war against the working class in the United States. And so we're seeing that in kind of a literal sense in California, where there's troops in the streets backing up ICE officers who are just shamelessly looking like Gestapo villains wearing masks. Of course, it's not only happening in LA, it's happening in New York, it's happening all across the country. People see that. People see what's going on in Gaza. People see what's going on in Iran. The war is coming against queer people in very direct ways. People are aware that their hospitals are going to close when the big, beautiful bill passes. People are becoming increasingly aware that we're in like a hostile confrontation with the state, and Trump is the face of that. So on one hand, yeah, there's like a brunch nostalgia for the Biden years or the Obama years. On the other hand, there's this desire to put people in power who are actually willing to fight in the way that Chuck Schumer refuses to do so. And so I think, yeah, his Mamdani's election and like the candidates who are going to, you know, this is an off year. The real election comes next year, right? The midterms. This is setting the tone for like what kind of candidates the Democrats are going to run next year and how we're going to face this onslaught against the working class. And I think Brad Lander's arrest is significant in that regard, because, you know, he wasn't trying to fight ICE. He was just trying to protect this guy coming in and out of his court date, and he got arrested for it. And so I think people weren't outraged that Lander was arrested, but that there are these Gestapo thugs in the courthouses rounding people up who are just workers trying to do what they've been asked to do to stay in the country and keep working. What the Democrats ought to do in their own regard is say, like, we have the working classes back. You know, we're going to protect them from being rounded up and put into internment camps. And what we ought to do is say, yeah, we agree with that. You know, we have to stop this militarized political power. We have to stop war. We have to stop ICE. But also, our goal isn't just to protect the workers. It's to put them on the offensive. And we've only seen an inkling of that from LA. You know, this is going to continue to heighten. And in a year's time, things are not going to be calm and quiet. This is going to continue to expand. And it's going to expand within the political terrain of these elections.
So I have an interesting proposition that's going to combine what you're saying and what Sean is saying, and then I'm going to let Sean talk. One of the things I find interesting about the difference in our attitude towards war today, post 9/11, is that war may be a good way to return certain levels of profitability, because when you drop bombs, you destroy overproduction. There's other ways to do that. You can invest it into education. You can do all kinds of things that destroys overproduction because they're not productive to surplus capital. But one of the things that sound interesting is during the social compact period, you know, for all of our complaints about malice, and I have many, they're right about one thing. And I'm not talking about a labor aristocracy in the first world worker was always reprobate or bought off. But there was a sense that the social compact that that world created meant that the profits from war actually broadly did go into the industrial sector of the working class, particularly that was white. And they benefited from it in its aftermath, not during, because they were dying en masse. But the 50s, the primary policy memory of baby boomers that set up the world that we lived through in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and even 90s is a result of that. And we have now seen it undone. And what that means for two things is most workers don't actually benefit from war. They don't anymore in a real sense. I don't just mean in like the abstract sense they get killed in war, but like for most of the 20th century, it was actually not true that the workers had no country. It wasn't. I mean, I would love for it to have been otherwise, but if we look at the votes and what was done between 1914 to 1980, maybe even into the 90s, workers were on the war machine tip. They were. We might not like it. There was opposition to it from the workers, but the vast majority of them voted for it over and over again. And I think they did it because they benefited. It wasn't because they hated people. They don't, you know, this is not like, I mean, yes, there are plenty of racists out there, but that wasn't what was going on. So that element of warfare today, because that social compact is gone, because the Treaty of Detroit is over, because of all that stuff, that is no longer going to motivate people to support war. And what they're going to see is people who are a lot like them dying. And there's nothing buying them off, basically, anymore. Similar, I actually think it's somewhat similar to racism. I mean, like, one of the things I used to tell people, like, oh, why are there so many white people participating in BLM? And I'm like, well, I mean, honestly, they can see what's happening to the black community happening to them now. They're not getting the benefits of white skin privilege in the same way. And while they might be annoyed when you shame like working class people about their privilege or whatever, in the broad sense, they can see where the tides are turning. And I think that's true, too. And when nothing came out of that, even amongst the people of color,
hey folks, Sean KB here. Just a reminder that our show relies on your support. So if you enjoy what we do and you want to hear more excellent bonus content, you can become a patron at patreon.com/theantifada. It's cheap, there's a ton of content, and it would mean everything to us. So thank you, and we'll see you behind the paywall.